Welcome, everyone. I'm not sure who's the crazier one if you're in here on a day like this. I really appreciate your moment of supererogation coming to a talk when the day is sunshiny, no wind, beautiful outside. So thanks for coming. I'm Roy Hammerling. For those of you that are just coming into the camp, I teach at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and I'm a church historian there. And the theme that I've been using for the week is this idea called the Mysterium Tremendum, it translates terrible, wondrous, beautiful mystery of God. It's a very complicated term, a term that was used in the Middle Ages to try to describe who God is in relationship to humanity. And I'll talk about this other just briefly, but what I've been doing to start each day off is something that we're trying to work on at Concordia a little bit with students, is kind of taking contemplative moments before classes start, times of kind of centering, and I call mine kind of mindfulness moments. And you can do them in a variety of ways, but most of the time what I do is just have a moment of silence, some moments of silence, and then during that time, you can do as you want with your thoughts. You can pray, you can let your whatever concerns are in your mind. I sometimes say it might be helpful to think of your concerns as like clouds, and you can just let them float on by. Maybe you want to blow them out of the way. If there are things that you want to kind of, that have been bothering you, you can kind of use some mental imagery there. At the end of that, I'll read a few short words. You can keep your minds, you can do this with your eyes closed or open, whatever you're most comfortable with. And then we'll begin the session. So let's take a moment of mindfulness. Just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members are the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. And in the one Spirit, we were all baptized into one body, Jew, Greek, slave, free. We were all made to drink of one Spirit. God has arranged the body, giving the greater honor to the inferior member, that there may be no dissension within the body, but the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together with it. It was Mary's painful need that made the infant Jesus begin to speak from the cradle. Whatever grew has grown for the sake of those in need, so that a seeker might find the things she sought. If God Most High has created the heavens, he created them for the purpose of satisfying a need. Wherever a pain is, that's where the cure goes. Wherever poverty is, that's where the provision goes. Wherever a difficult question is, that is where the answer goes. Wherever a ship is, that is where the water goes. Don't seek the water. Just increase your thirst. Until the tender-throated babe is born, how should the milk for it flow from the mother's breast? The first reading was from 1 Corinthians, as you all know. The second was from the mystic poet Rumi from the 13th century. Well, what we've been doing so far, I've been talking about this mystery, trying to understand how we come to understand the mystery of God and at what places we encounter that. And I'm using a term from the Celtic spirituality author John O'Donohue, whose book Beauty, The Invisible and Grace has many of these ideas, but the idea of thin places, that there are thin places in the world in which we come into closer proximity with the divine and brush the divine. And those experiences often are transformative. They help us see the world in a different way and help us focus and live our lives differently. And in that sense, there's two wonders, the wonder of the Word, which Fred has been talking about in the morning. And I'm going to shift to what I call the wonder of the world. And I have a number of these ideas that I have on the board, but yesterday we looked at the wonder of nature. Today we're going to look at the wonder of community or the wonder of the good life. Tomorrow we're going to look at suffering. And then finally on Friday I'll finish up dealing with joy. I had two options today with regard to thinking about the wonder of community. Community, when we think about it, we've been working with a definition by Friedrich von Hugel that religious traditions organize themselves around an institutional structure and traditional ideas around beliefs and intellectual thought. And then Hugel also argues that there is a mystical element, an experiential element to faith, that's really important, that we're all mystics in the sense that we've all had these moments and places of thin places where we felt close to the divine or to somebody else, to ourselves, to an enemy, even to nature. And in those moments, time has slowed down, something I call thick time, in which you find what Augustine would say, eternity in the moment. And I'll talk a lot more about that on Friday. So how do we get at the mystery of community? And yesterday when I talked about nature, I tried to just talk about the wonder of community and how it kind of comes to us through beauty and overwhelms us in a moment. And I could have done that today, but recently I've had a few experiences which are going to lead me to go in a different direction. Paul asked a question the other day about, can we create moments of mystery? And I said, you know, really, especially on the last day, I'll explore this a lot, but the idea that mystery comes to us unbidden, often unexpectedly, and in a way that we never dream of, and so we can't really control it, but we can do certain things like retreat to Holden and go on a walk and have almost a lifetime of experiences running into deer here that I'll never have the rest of my life, right? I've seen more deer in a few days here than I probably, and as close as I've seen them as I will have for my, so I can do some things along this way. So I'm gonna suggest, I'm gonna talk a little bit about what I think about is the problem of community today and how we might try to recapture the mystery in our society today and deal with some of the problems. And this comes out of two issues. A friend of mine who's a commissioner in Fargo asked me to speak. They have this thing going on in Fargo where they want us to try to think creatively about how we create community in Fargo. And his idea was that he would have a series of sessions in which he would have a diverse group of people speaking and try to get them in dialogue. So they asked me, a medievalist, to start it. It sounded absolutely crazy, right? Why would you ask a medievalist to talk about modern community? And what I did is I went back and I talked about some ancient authors. And what that led was to a conversation with me and some architects talking about how the ideas I had about community might be brought into architecture. And it was really a really interesting group of conversations that I had. We had social workers and all these sorts of people. And so part of my ideas today come from those conversations and some of the problems that we see within society. And the question that I was also then asked to speak to the North Dakota League of Cities, which is basically the mayors and city council people, police chiefs and things like that, on the same issue, to take the question one step further. And we were really trying to address the problem in Western North Dakota where we have an oil boom going on, and we have all these oil workers, and then we have these people that have lived there for generations and who have these farms, and how do we get these two groups to form a community? It's a very difficult problem. And so I was asked to try to speak to that a little bit. So some of these ideas are coming from those two talks that I've given. One of the assumptions that I make is that we all know a little bit about the mystery of community. We have community on a number of levels. We have the community of, like, my family, my local community of Fargo, the state of North Dakota, my home state of Washington, the United States, we have the world. So we can talk about it in a broad way. And I'm going to speak more broadly speaking today rather than on a micro level. I hope that will eventually, my ideas will push into the micro level as well. But I want to start, when I was first asked to give this talk in Fargo, I was horrified. I had no idea really what I was going to say. And I had a dream. And I don't know what else to make of it, but I had this dream before that talk, which also informed my other talk, which also informs my ideas today. And I want to tell you about my dream. I really was struggling with how do you get at this issue, and suddenly my grandfather, Christian Hemmerling, came to me in a dream. He was born in 1897. If he were alive today, he'd be 115 years old. He died 30 years ago. And he came to me, and I was walking along, and I saw him in his garden, and he was weeding and pulling out weeds. Now, let me give you a little background. My grandfather grew up in the steppes of Russia, in the Ukraine. He was a German-Russian, and they went there during the reign of Catherine the Great. They were asked to farm this area. Are there any other German-Russians in the room?
No, I am.
I knew Dennis was, so we have to talk about this on the conversation out on the boat. Well, so these German Russians were there for a few generations, and then what happened was Hitler signed a 10-year non-aggression pact with Stalin, and a part of that 10-year non-aggression pact was that the German Russians had to move to Czechoslovakia or Poland. My family was resettled into Poland, and then war broke out, and they became refugees for the rest of the war. With my grandfather and his eight children and wife. So as they were there, they eventually, after the war, they didn't find much to live for in Germany. They had lost everything twice. And so they decided to come and immigrate to the United States. He lived next door to me in Odessa, Washington, where I'm from. And so I often saw him in his garden. He was a master gardener. And so when I saw him in the dream, it felt perfectly natural to see him in his garden pulling his weeds. Now, he was blind, but had a little bit of shadow vision, so he had to let the weeds grow up big, and he'd go like, you know, that's how he grabbed weeds, and that's how I saw him. So as soon as he hears me coming, he says in German, "Wer ist das?" And you know, he speaks German, and I would speak, he really never learned English in the United States, and I would speak either German or English back to him, so I'll translate everything we said. He said, "Who's that?" And I said, "It's just me, Grandpa." And Opa, really, is what I call him. And he says, "I haven't seen you for a long time. Where have you been?" I said, "You've been dead for 30 years, you know. What do you mean? I don't even know how to respond to that, you know." I said, "I'm living in North Dakota, I guess. You know, I haven't been to Odessa for a while. And even in my dreams. And, I'm teaching at Concordia." And he said, "That's no excuse." You know, this is my grandfather's gruff manner. He said, "Well, so I'm dead, huh?" And I said, "Well, yeah, you know, I don't know how else." And dreams are, you know, you just kind of go with it. You know? But I said, you know, and then I was feeling bad. He looked kind of hurt. And I said, "But you're still a part of my life. I still love you." And he says, "You got that right, you know." And he says, "Do you know what's wrong with the world today?" Well, I knew he was going to tell me. So he says, "Nobody cares anymore. Sure, it wasn't really great in my day. We had guys like Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, the Great World War. Wasn't any better in those days.
days.
But we had each other. We had our family. We had friends. And you know, we even at times had enemies who took care of us. You know what that was like. We were Germans. And after the war, we were refugees. And then along came our enemies, the Americans. And they gave us food and clothing and medicine. That's why we left Germany, because our enemies treated us with kindness. And we said, if we wanted to be the people that we want to be, let's be like enemies who are kind to us. And today, I look at America, and you're not kind anymore. Why do you fight so much amongst yourselves? Political parties are a joke. They can't agree on anything except the fact that they want the other one to fail. Sure, now and then people work for the common good. A tsunami might make people send relief. A flood in Fargo helps people get together. But how do you find good community anymore? How do you get along? You can't even be kind to each other. Is it really that hard? If only individuals shared and communities cared, you could do so much. You have so much money, and all you do is spend it on paint, making states blue or red. Elections are not about issues, they are about assassinations of character. I feel sorry for you and your children. Businessmen and women steal the hard-earned wages of people. Entire companies fail because of greed. What happened to the country I moved to? And I said, you're right. He says, I know I'm right. Okay. And then he said, come here, help me with this weed. So we both pull out this weed and throw it on the pile. And he walks away. So he says, what the hell are you going to do about it? And then I woke up. Well, needless to say, when I woke up, I was in a bit of a sweat. But it was interesting that, the dream is still very real to me, and I don't know what to make of it. I certainly don't claim to be a prophet after this morning session with Fred. I don't want to have any of that suffering or misery on my head. But in order to create good communities, we need to realize a few things. And one of the things that I was so struck by was by my grandfather's words was that, you know, we moved to America because our enemies showed love to us. We wanted to be like that enemy. And I started thinking about his situation, what he grew up in, and during the war. My family were Germans. One of my uncles, who was my grandfather's, my dad's brother, he became a bodyguard for Hitler and was there at the bunker during World War II. So my family had Nazi sensitivities during the war. And I met my uncle, and we talked about, you know, his involvement in the war, and he said, what people forget is that the Nazis were humans. And I thought, when he made that comment, I thought of the play and the movie Playing for Time. Where it's a true story about Fania Fenelon. Do you know this story? She was a Jewish woman who was in Auschwitz, and she survived Auschwitz because she was a violinist. And they had a little chamber orchestra, and they would play together for the Nazis, play Bach and Beethoven and all the great music, and because she was of some use to them, they liked hearing good music, she just survived. And one time after they were done playing a heartbreakingly beautiful piece of classical music, one of the musicians, as the other ones left, he says, these Nazis are monsters. And Fania says, no, they're not. If they were monsters, we could dismiss them. Because monsters are just evil. No, they're human. That's the problem. It's a powerful and important line. I take a number of groups abroad regularly, and a few years I did a Luther tour. I'm a Luther scholar on our campus, and I took a group of alumni to Dachau as a part of the tour. I was reminded when I was at Dachau, there's a big poster there. You can go online and see it. A big poster of the prisoners that were in Dachau. And you would have like the Jewish star, of course, for the Jews, but there was another 20 other sorts of stars that other people wore. A pink triangle for homosexuals, a black triangle for political prisoners, women that were supposedly prostitutes, may have been or maybe weren't, were just accused of it, they had their own triangle, gypsies, people that were mentally or physically handicapped, all of these sorts of things. It was a great big long list. And as I was staring at this list and thinking about what must the Nazis think is the way to create a good society, it seemed like it was a very simple formula. Let's have everybody be like us. And if there is an other in our community, we must remove them. Because the other is a threat to the way we think and the way we act and the way we live out our lives. And so the true test then of a society, it seems to me, is how it treats the other and how it works for the common good. My life was dramatically changed because an enemy showed kindness to my grandparents at some point in their lives, and I became my enemy. Perhaps the clearest statement about this is, of course, from Jesus, Matthew 6. You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good and sends the rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet or love only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? So therefore I say, be perfect as your Father is perfect. Fred used the phrase the other day about hard sayings in the scriptures. And we get to that, be perfect and love your enemies. That's a hard saying. There are no limits on what Jesus puts here. The Nazi era becomes like a mirror shining back at us, looking at us, and saying, what will we do to create a good society? January 8th, a few years ago, Jared Lee Lochner, 22-year-old man, down in Arizona, shot District Judge John Roll and U.S. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and 17 others and killed 6 other people. When he was asked why, as he said, he disagreed with their politics. How do we get to this from where my grandfather said is what has happened to America from the time he came to where we are here today and we have this? I want to suggest a way, hopefully, to try to regain the mystery. And I want to, first of all, go back again to World War II, the time when my parents were refugees and my grandfather was a refugee. At that time, London was also being bombed by the Nazis. And as a result, the children were all taken out of London, sent out to the countryside to relatives so that they could be spared. And a young medievalist, was asked to go onto the radio to suggest a way that the people of London could deal with the differences and come together and find a way to deal with the struggle. His name was C.S. Lewis, and he did this radio address, which is now in a book called Mere Christianity. If you go back and read the book and look at the introduction, there's a very interesting metaphor that Lewis uses at the beginning. And I'm going to expand it a little bit and add to it to kind of suggest a way of thinking about how we might create better community or find mystery in community. Lewis says, I'm going to do a little bit of quoting here, that when we are living in, when we live in a society, he's looking at London and he's saying, and England, he says, we all live, let's imagine we all live in the same mansion. And we all have our own little rooms that we live in. How is it that we can create the good life, a better life for ourselves here? Well, Lewis says, it's not going to be by me forcing my way into your room and making you believe what I believe. And it's not going to happen by us being mad at each other or hiding up in our rooms. The way it'll happen is we need to coax each other into the hallway. Let's have some hallway conversations. Now you, if you're, he was Episcopalian, if you're Episcopalian or Anglican, you're going to go into this room, and your room is going to have ritual and beautiful ways of worship that are familiar to you but are very strange to the Jew and the Muslim and the Roman Catholic and the atheists who live down the hall. They're all going to go to their own rooms, and they're all going to find comfort in their own rooms. But it's the hallway that we need to find a place to have conversation, because we all live in the same house. And so that was his impetus for starting a conversation which he hoped would lead not only to see some of the commonality that people had, that they were all living in the same house and that they all had the same concerns for a good community, but also that he was hoping that they might be able to work for the common good in the end. It basically takes a little bit of curiosity, a little bit of energy, and also a willingness to risk. After the January 8th shooting, when Gabrielle Giffords was shot, unfortunately she is recovering now, there was a kind of a national outcry. A number of people were concerned about what the level of political dialogue had gotten to in the United States. And Krista Tippett, if you go on, NPR did this thing called Civil Conversations. And I don't know if anybody saw that, but she said what we need to recover is a way of having civil conversations. And her ideas, when I was listening to it, I thought, this really reminds me of Lewis, saying we have to find a way to get into the hallway. We don't have to be each other. We just have to find a way to have a conversation. And we, first of all, I think Elizabeth Alexander, who is a professor of African American Studies at Yale and who wrote the poem Praise Song for a Day, which was read at President Obama's inauguration, might say it best. She said in an interview, "Unless we have loving curiosity for the other, we will never be able to create a good society." So the first thing we need is a loving curiosity for the other, a curiosity that will lure us into the hall to have a conversation. But often our language has failed us. We have come to a place in our society, I think my grandfather's, that paint image really struck me. You know, you spend your money on paint, like, what the heck are you talking about? And then blue and red states, and I thought, wow, he's up to date on stuff. I didn't know that. But as I started thinking about it, we have entire news programs that feed our own ideologies. You know, we have a Fox News, CNBC, and these things are driving us to our own rooms so that we shout out at our windows at each other and never try to meet them in the hallways, right? And so we need to somehow break down the barriers of this and find a way to get back into the hallway. President Obama is not a Muslim. Evangelical Christians are not all bigots. We have to look from both sides and say, how do we get into this hallway? The real question is, can we find the mystery in each other again? My grandfather found the mystery in a person, you know, he couldn't imagine that the Americans would be kind to him. Why would it be that they would do this? And that created a mystery and a longing for him to find something better. But we have used words in a problematic way. Sometimes I grew up with my parents telling me, we need to tolerate other people in our community. That word tolerate doesn't work anymore, because it suggests that, well, we'll put up with them, right? And that's not a loving curiosity to get into the hallway, but that's kind of how it worked. The other day I told the story about being in Pakistan and praying with a Muslim in worship. I want to tell another story about Pakistan. My son's a filmmaker, and we went to Pakistan to make a film. And part of what we needed to do, we went to a very, very poor village. And we were filming the village, and as we were filming very early in the morning, suddenly the children started coming out. You know, the Americans in Pakistan back in 2008 was not your normal sight. And we were there, and suddenly the parents came out, and you know, through an interpreter, we told them what we were doing. We were making a film about Iqbal, who was one of the great leaders of the West, of Pakistan, who has some ideas I think that will help us figure out how to get along with each other. Iqbal has, just really quick, Iqbal has one idea. He said, he died in 1938. He said, the East and the West are like the two hands of the same person. If the right hand cuts off the left, or if the left cuts off the right, it does not matter. The person is still wounded. We need to find a way to use these hands to work together. So we, my son was using Iqbal as a way to try to deal with the conflict with Islam and Christianity. And so we were there, and we were in this village, and so we wanted to do some filming because we wanted to try to show some of the poverty there. As we were trying to get away, and that's what we were trying to do, it was very difficult. They invited us for dinner. Now, people who have nothing are giving you everything if they're inviting you for dinner. So we kept saying, no, 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 but they insisted. And they gave us everything they had. We could see that they gave everything off their shelves for us. To which we felt tremendously guilty, and we went to a, after we were done, we went and got some groceries, and we put them in the village for these people who had taken care of us, and then we ran. Because we didn't want them, you know. We would have been enveloped. Later on, I went, one of my Muslim friends, her father had died, and she wanted to give alms, and as part of the ritual. So we went, and she said, will you help me share the alms? And I said, you know, my father died a while ago, so I said, yes, I'll do that. And she said, well, we'll share it together. We'll give alms for our fathers to give, go to the poor. And so we went to this place to buy food, and we bought a fair amount of food, and we went into this very, very poor neighborhood and immediately were swamped. It was a scary feeling, to be quite honest. But the poverty was incredible. And yet, they were willing to give us curiosity, love, compassion. And in those brief moments, we felt the love of, and mystery of the other. Well, so how do we embrace the mystery of otherness? How do we do that? Well, we have to get into the hallway. Right now I'm working on a book on Luther and prayer. And one of the things I was really struck by was an image that Luther keeps coming back to in prayer. In fact, it's the last words that he has before he dies. Luther says that the proper way of understanding our human condition, says Luther, is that we are all beggars. There is nothing that we have on this earth that we have not been given. We are like the beggar. He uses a number of images. One of them is like we're a poor beggar harlot who is married to the king who makes us a queen. We are like a poor beggar who's lying in his own sickness and filth and can't clean himself, and the king comes and cleans us for ourselves because we can't even do it. Luther's idea is a flattening of the playing field. Everybody is a beggar. There is no difference in some sense. Even though there's otherness between us, Luther suggests that the great D.T. Niles, quote, we are nothing but beggars who help other beggars to find bread. And if we know where to find bread, we take the beggars there ourselves. But is that anything that we offer? No, the gift comes from beyond ourselves. So we need to find a way to embrace difference, but also realize our similarities. Let me just use a few examples. Francis Kissling is a Roman Catholic who was a president of Catholics for Choice. It's an abortion rights activist group. And she and Sidney Callahan, who is against abortion, have been working very hard to try to find ways to dialogue with each other. These people have nothing, almost nothing in common. But Francis Kissling has said, the hallmark of civil debate and conversation is that when we acknowledge that which is good in the position of the person that we disagree with, and the weakness of our own position, and therefore become vulnerable to the other. We must be humble in our dialogue with others with whom we disagree. We don't have to give up our positions, but we have to acknowledge our own weaknesses. Kwame Anthony Appiah, who wrote the books Cosmopolitanism and Honor Code, who's a professor of philosophy at Princeton, has said that we are in a society that is so divided that the best we can probably do is this phrase, sidle up to our differences. Let's sidle up to our differences and find a way to make things work. He uses a number of illustrations, but I'll make it my own. I belong to a church in Fargo, North Dakota, St. John Lutheran Church. Nice little church. I do adult ed things a lot of times. And usually, adult ed turns into my friend Nick, who died recently and I miss dearly, who is a part of the Republican Party, National Party in North Dakota, one of the people that runs the party. Nick is there, my friends for the Obamas over here, and I have two really loud Ron Paul supporters. And we have this great dialogue, and we know we don't agree on the issues, and yet when I go to the Salvation Army, they're standing next to me and we're serving together. When we bring in the when we bring in refugees, we're the ones that are always side by side. So we have these differences, and yet we still work for the common good. We still are able to find our way. That's what mosques, synagogues, churches, temples, whatever you have, that's what they do. They try to find a way to live in the mystery despite, we do not let politics get in the way of being the people we think we need to be in a society. Now, I still disagree with them, and sometimes the conversations get very heated, but that's okay. We're sidling up to our differences. The goal is not to agree necessarily. The goal is to search for the common good amidst our disagreements. Richard Moe, who is an evangelical Christian theologian, the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, has written a book called Uncommon Decency, Christian Civility in an Uncivil World. He says that one of the things that we need to do is to find a way to set aside our hatreds, because hatred is uncivil. It's unchristian. How do we get back to that mystery of love, even though we might have differences? Now, Richard Moe and I disagree on a number of things. He's very against homosexuals having the right to have marriage. And he just thinks it's between a man and a woman. And yet, he knows, even though we have these differences, he says, I always ask myself, what is it about people like me that scares you so much? And what is it about you that you're advocating that worries me so much? I must look at myself in order to find a common ground. Remember the Cold War. A few of us are old enough to remember the Cold War. Many of us are. Remember the Cold War. But remember how those days used to go? How we used to fling terms around? Communists, socialists. We still have those terms going around. Our language has failed us. We have to find a new language and a new way to get together. G.K. Chesterton, the great Roman Catholic, once said, it's not only bad to have false gods, it's also bad to have false demons. And we often make demons of the other, right? Whether we agree or disagree with them. And Yeats, the great poet Yeats said, the best in our societies tend to lack conviction, while the worst in our society have passionate intensity. And I think one of the things Richard Moe is trying to get at is saying we need uncommon civility. The civility that we demand today takes great bravery, great courage, and perhaps great suffering. Maybe we're edging into the prophetic stage here, not to denounce others, but rather to find ways to get others to be in the hallway with us so we can have convicted civility. We can be convicted and civil at the same time, says Martin Marty. In his books that talk about this. But Martin Marty says the same problem as Yeats. The convicted are not civil and the civil are not convicted. We need to find convicted civility. Ideas that help us transform the place we're in. Vincent Harding, a civil rights leader, a speechwriter for Martin Luther King and friend of Martin Luther King Jr.'s, recently asked in a speech, is America possible anymore? is it possible anymore amidst the debate? His answer is yes. But only, and then he moves to Martin Luther King's language, if we can find a way to become a beloved community which embraces all differences and all otherness. Not like the Nazi labeling, but rather a way of sidling up to these sorts of ways of getting into the hallway and not be discouraged. It's funny, I was so struck by my grandfather's dream, especially that last idea, that he's somehow picking weeds and making his garden better, and he wants me to help him with it. And then he says, so what are you going to do? And all of a sudden, then I have these opportunities to speak, and I don't quite understand, you know, what this medievalist is doing here. But I am curious about the whole notion that I do passionately believe that there is a wonder and mystery to community that if we work hard at it, and if we are brave and are not discouraged, because there will be a never end to the process. Dorothy Zala says, we need to live as if the world has already been liberated. To keep fighting, to keep moving on these issues. And I can think of one powerful example that comes to us from Wyoming that might help us a little bit. In 1998, in Laramie, Wyoming, we all know that Matthew Fisher, a University of Wyoming student, was tortured and beaten to death. During the trial, the witnesses said that part of the reasons for their motivations for dealing with this young man this way was because he was homosexual. This created a terrible crisis in the community of Laramie. And so there, a young artist by the name of Moises Kaufman, who is a son of Romanian parents, exactly from the place where the region where my grandparents were from. So I was really struck by some of this. He was of Jewish descendants. His parents eventually moved to Venezuela. He finally made his way to New York, and he became a playwright. And he wasn't sure what to do as an artist. He thought, maybe I can try to help. So he went to Laramie exactly a year after the events of Matthew Shepard. And he started interviewing people. And he named his first play The Laramie Project. Some of you may have seen it. It was on HBO. And then he went back 10 years later and did it again to see if there had been any change in the society. And I watched both of the projects and was really struck. I was trying to see has there been any movement in the community? How have things changed? And what was remarkable to me was the attitudes of some of the people, particularly the policemen in the community. Early on, you know, the policemen said things like, it was a prank that just got out of hand. It wasn't really that, you know, the kids, you know, they're young and they were drunk and they, you know, we should be easy on them. The second time, they said, well, we realized suddenly that we weren't really protecting everybody in our society. We weren't taking care of the homosexual student or the person that's homosexual. So we started meeting with homosexual groups to try to get a better understanding of who they were. And over time, they became some of the greatest advocates in that society. They showed uncommon civility. They showed curiosity. They showed a loving compassion to try to get beyond who they were and their prejudices of the other, and became important members of this solution. And I thought, now this artist comes in here and he tells the story, and this story is bringing not only healing to Laramie, but hopefully raising awareness and healing elsewhere. How many of you have heard somebody say, aren't the tragic deaths of these young people something that we need to use as a way to make our society better? Does it take deaths for us to finally find a good society? I became my enemy, says my grandfather, because of the kindness that my enemy showed me. I'm an American because of the kindness Americans showed my grandfather, despite the fact he probably didn't deserve it. So my grandfather's words are there. What are you going to do? What strangers need your compassion? What others in your community need your curiosity? So that we will no longer live in our own rooms, isolated and alone, listening to our own favorite TV programs, but will come out and seek and work for the common good. What enemy do we need to become? If we want to be God's mysterious community, we'll need uncommon civility, uncommon decency, convicted civility, and the courage and compassion to know the other and the vulnerability for ourselves to be changed. And then my grandfather's words still echo, so what are you going to do about it? So what do you think? What are we going to do about it? Any thoughts? Comments? Questions? Yeah.
In my church, we recently became a Reconciling in Christ church, and as we looked at that, our motivation was actually to help gay and lesbian people. But we looked at our making a welcoming statement, and it had to include several other groups in our society that are commonly discriminated against, like the poor. And so that was an interesting process for us to be more inclusive, because we were narrow. Our focus was narrow, but it became wider. And now we see other people showing up that are different than the people we had before.
Why do you think we get narrow?
Tradition.
I'm from everybody, but what? Tradition?
Comfort.
Language, fear of the other.
Habit.
What's that?
Habit.
It's more comfortable and easier to stay in your room, isn't it? And I think the Nazis would say all those things too, you know, right? I can point at myself. I always tell my students, you know, you talk about 6 degrees of separation. Remember that Omni magazine study back in the 1980s? They did this experiment where they took cards and they wrote down a person's name and address, and then they went, like somebody from the United States, they went to India to a tiny village and gave the card to somebody and said, okay, you have to hand this to somebody who's going to hand it to somebody else to eventually give it to the person in the United States. It could not be mailed or any of that sort of stuff. And they did that, and they found that there was only 6 degrees of separation between any person on the earth to somebody else. It was an average of 6 names. So I tell my students, my uncle was a bodyguard of Hitler, so now you're only 2 degrees of separation from Hitler. Hmm. We tend to see that society, that world, as being a lot farther away than it really is. And unfortunately, many of the elements of that society, cloaked in other sorts of language, are still a part of our society, aren't they? I mean, they're here. And I'm horrified when I see it myself.
Is Odessa still a closed community in any way?
Odessa, Washington has changed a little bit since I was there. I went and visited some friends there, but it's mostly a German-Russian, you know, still a German-Russian community. But they've had some, a lot of people are retiring there because it's cheap.
So I just wonder if there's a lot of that still where you have your communities that are kind of cohesive but closed to the outside.
Well, here was the issue. One of the things we tried to talk about in Williston, North Dakota, was the problem of all these oil workers coming in and then these farmers that live there. And suddenly what's happening is elderly and teachers who live in apartment buildings, the rent is raised from $700 to $2,000 in a month, and they're forced out. They have no place to go. And how do you live in a community where you're walking down the aisle at the grocery store and there's nothing left on the shelves because people have bought everything? And this is your community. And you know, there's a lot of animosity between the oil workers and the people that live there, especially if they don't have oil rights. If you have oil rights, you can at least, you know, you can afford to go to, you know, buy everything. Actually, the friends I know buy everything online because they can't find anything in the stores there. They have UPS deliver it from somewhere else. But you know, these are tense problems, and trying to get people to sit down and have conversations are really, really difficult. I don't know, other thoughts or
Just wondering, and I don't have any idea how, but it seems like somehow, maybe through C.S. Lewis and so on, there's something about children that soften red and blue, and soften ideology, and the common good seems to be a little more we can agree more on the common good if we're thinking about the children, maybe.
Well, we need the hope of the youth terribly. Sarah's a former student of mine. I was talking with Anders, and there was another student here in the seminary, and there's another one in the back. When I look at the seminarians like Sarah and them, I have a lot of hope that this energetic, bright, compassionate young group of people will help us. But we've got to help them too. But I am very encouraged. You know, at least I have hope for that, because a lot of the students I see, and I do a lot of, when I have conversations in class, and I'm sure Fred is like this too, when you're teaching, on the one hand, you sit in wonder of the young who have this boundless energy and desire to make the world a better place, and you encourage them. Sometimes you despair because they don't work very hard. But there are those that do, and it's like that flash of that it's hope for us. You're right. I agree. I do have some hope, but we're really messing it up. And are we messing it up to the point of no return? I like to think Vincent Harding's right. Yes, it is. We can make a difference. We can find the beloved community, but we have to kind of somehow get back to the mystery and beauty of the other. And that's being lost in the shrill vitriolic debates that I hear today. And I'm worried about it. I can't hardly even watch the political stuff anymore. I just like it sucks the life right out of me. I can't stand it. But we're moving into that season.
Two musicals come to mind. One is South Pacific, and the other one is Oklahoma. And both speak to this issue as a story, as a musical.
Well, and one of the things I put up on this up here, imagination, which I would include the arts. I think the arts and what Moishe Kaufman did in writing the Laramie Project is that the arts are thin places by which we can see ourselves and see God and the other more clearly. And I used the example yesterday of Harriet Beecher Stowe and her love of nature, which eventually led her to write Uncle Tom's Cabin. As a method that really changed the world dramatically. Now, maybe it was a terrible way with the war, but in any case, it raised the issue for making the world a better place. How do we do that? I think we have to find ways to get people of different minds and different opinions into the hallway. And we're trying to do that in Fargo. I'm very encouraged by the fact that we actually have a couple politicians that want to try this. And but it's an experiment. It seems completely strange to me.
Last year I was part of a project that was working on childhood obesity in Logan Square in Chicago. And we read the book called Community, The Structure of Belonging by Peter Block. And he talks about how in engaging issues in a community and working towards a more civil society, how important it is to bring in people from various sectors of a neighborhood to just have a conversation. So we tried it, and I remember how powerful it was. We started with the question, what is the commitment you bring to this conversation? And so we had a physician who was concerned about the state of children and their health. We had a mother who works three jobs and it's not safe for her children to walk home from school, so they don't walk. We had a public safety guy who talked about lighting and how that affects children being able to play outside. And it was just really, I don't know, it's one model that I think bears some promise for how we bring people together. Because part of the problem is, do people even want to come into the hallway? Well, but then once we're there, how does that...
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm interrupting.
No.
The point I want to really make, I think, is right. We are, it's a nice idea, but I'm too busy.
Exactly. You know? And we face that a lot.
And you hear that all the time. I remember when the Fargo Commission says, we want you to talk about community. I think, oh man, how am I going to find time to write that? It was right during finals. And I was kind of, And then he kind of told me his vision. I thought, well, yeah, I really agree with that, but can't you do this in, you know, in the summer when I'm off or something? You know, it was funny, but and then all of a sudden he kept saying, but this is really important. And I said, well, yeah, you're right. And he just pulled me out, way out of my comfort zone. I didn't really want to do it at first. And I think my grandfather's dream is some sort of my subconscious saying, what's wrong with you? You know, we have to find a way to do this. I mean, yeah, but I agree. It's that busyness factor and the resistance in our society.
Your talk this morning has helped me understand for the first time ever, really, I think Psalm 133 as a picture of a thin spot in community. It's that thing that used to always just gross me out because of all the oil and stuff. How very good and pleasant it is when kindred live together in unity. Like the precious oil on the head running down upon the beard and all that. And then the last line is, and I never thought about this before until quite this way, for there the Lord ordained his blessing life forevermore. In other words, when you've seen that, you've seen eternal life.
How true. And where do groups, it's Jesus' images of heaven are often wedding feasts, right? And the wedding feast is the one time when the family, with all its differences, kind of gets along, kind of. And they kind of set it aside. And it's the same sort of thing, isn't it? Getting back to Paul's idea, it's that moment when mystery kind of breaks in. When community really works, it is a beautiful thing. It's mysterious. It's wondrous. And the psalmist's longing for it. You know, and even our longing, don't we all long for it? We all know that we want the common good.
How do we turn this train around with the politics?
I don't know. I think one of the things that we're trying to do in Fargo is, I'm working with the Fargo City Commissioner, and he said one of the things that he does, he's actually using the media, the internet, as a way to get around politicians. And what he does is we have these forums, and then we went out and said, okay, we've heard these ideas, we put these talks on YouTube, now give us what you think the community really needs to be a better community. For example, one of the things I think that's a problem in our society in America is that we really have no public spaces, or very few, where communities can get together and celebrate and be with each other in difference. For in Fargo, where do we go? You know, we have a downtown area that's, you know, I mean, you have to shut off the streets to have a fair, right? So we try to do that a little bit. So I was suggesting trying to find a way, like Canada and Winnipeg, they have this floodplain where they have these huge festivals where they get the city together.
Yeah.
And you can't really do anything with the floodplain anyway, so why not use this as a place to get together? You go to Europe, anywhere, there's piazzas, placas, all these sorts of places where you can gather and meet. So I think one of the things we were talking with the architects, how do we restructure the city so that we're suddenly able to meet with people in a way? People in Europe walk to the grocery stores and walk with each other along the streets as they're going place to place and things. We drive. There's no way. You know, we're on the cell phones texting them, you know, which puts our lives at risk.
The other thing is how to not become the enemy. You know, I'll give you an example. We did the Laramie Project at Augustana, at the theater department. Did the play, and we surrounded it with discussion and so on. And as soon as the publicity broke for the play, the pastor in Kansas, who shows up, forgetting his name.
Phelps.
Exactly. Started sending threats that he and his troops would be coming to Augustana. And so among the administrators on campus, it was to keep our students and our campus safe, but also how to respond to him without being just like it.
Oh yeah, exactly.
You know, because we would, you know, the impulse is, well, we're just going to kick him off. But then, we're doing the same thing he's doing, and we've just become the very thing we're objecting to.
No, and you're right, and that's one of the very first comments I said is we need people of great creativity, energy, and compassion to try to figure out how to solve this. A Colorado college had a similar situation where they had a very controversial thing, and the president. And all the faculty got together and said, how are we going to solve this problem? We're going to have, they actually invited a Palestinian and a Jewish, two Jewish authors to speak and dialogue and get going. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was a lot of people coming. They were really angry. And they asked the president what we should do. And he said, we just need more toilets. Make sure that the facilities, we got water out there. I was struck by this. I said, what? He was absolutely unflattered. He says, we need the dialogue so desperately that what we need to do is try to find it so that people, they're comfortable, they don't have, you know, they can find bathrooms, they get something to eat, you know, and we can take care of them. So he absolutely unflinching in letting the dialogue happen. But you're right, it's so easy to just simply move to becoming the other or becoming what we don't want to be. Sarah and I, we were talking, I said, the person that I was young, I no longer love. Because that person was a pretty rigid, different person than I am now. But I've been transformed, I think, by many encounters with the other, especially most recently in my encounters in Pakistan. And I don't know, getting to the point where we sometimes can say that, I think, is helpful. But
I was just thinking about what happened after 9/11. That there is this tremendous outpouring and reaching out and compassion within the city from all over the world, people that cared so compassionately. But our response has been tighter security, going to war, which I think heightens fear instead of, you know.
Exactly.
Why can't we go back and bond with food and water instead of.
We have 3,000 Muslims in Fargo. And when 9/11 happened, the community that reached out to them in compassion was the Jews.
Wow.
Now that's creativity. And the Christian community, we were there too. We have a interfaith group and we get together readily. But when the Jewish synagogue had swastikas painted on it, it was the Muslims that were there. We're trying. I think that's creative and necessary. But you're right. You know, when something like that happens, we respond with force.
And also pressure, like, aren't you patriotic enough?
Yeah, like what they did to France as far as the thing, you know, ostracizing them because they wouldn't join us.
Right? Yeah, so you don't eat French fries, right?
You know, years ago, there was a pastor teaching a Bible study here by the name of Peter Drury. Kanye and I visited his church on Capitol Hill, and on the door of his church, he said, "These doors are as wide open as Christ's love." They enumerated the other. And they were getting ready to have a visit from the people from Wyoming, and their plan
from Kansas.
Kansas, was it?
Yeah, that pastor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from Kansas.
That told him that he was coming.
And their plan was to take donuts and hot coffee out to give all those people, meet them with love. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's not the normal response, but probably.
Uncommon civility.
Yes, uncommon civility.
Well, you know, I said earlier I was hopeful because of people like Sarah and others that are here. I'm also very hopeful because of all people like you and what Holden represents. I mean, I think what Holden tries to do as a place. So thank you for coming. I'm over time. I wish you all the best. Tomorrow we'll talk about suffering.